Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture and to remind viewers that entertainment is not mindless.
Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 91. On this episode of the podcast, we're going to be talking about The Big Short. We're talking about The Big Short, again, much like most of the recent episodes, because it's Oscar season, and we wanted to highlight lots of these films that are gaining a lot of buzz with the Academy and in the general culture. So to help me talk about The Big Short, we're having on Clay Morgan, our resident civic studies expert, and our very own Gene Goesworth. So, this film is similar to Spotlight, another podcast we have recently put out, in the fact that it covers a huge crisis in our recent history. But it really differs in tone. Well, it completely differs in tone. Directed by Adam McKay, who you probably recognize from films like Anchorman and Step Brothers, and even the recent Ant-Man, tries to engage us by using comedy, which is more his forte. But lots of people were skeptical. How could you make a movie about the world financial crisis and millions of people losing everything that they've worked for and make it a comedy? Well, he uses something we call edutainment. And in that edutainment, he keeps us engaged for a very long time before he eventually sweeps in with cold reality. And it works beautifully. We all really enjoyed this film and we found it very important. And we can see why it was honored by the Academy. So, with many documentaries out there, we kind of ask ourselves if we needed another one. We talk about how this thing happened in the first place, if it's going to happen again, what led up to it, is anyone really a hero? Lots of great conversations. Speaking of great conversations, if you go to realworldtheology.com, you can find a lot of really great conversations happening. You can find our Facebook group, where we're having lots of great conversations, Twitter, our Facebook page, you can subscribe to the podcast. All these ways are great ways for you to get involved in the conversation, which we would appreciate. If you do that, please rate and review the show. It really, really helps our rankings, helps other people find the show, and helps people join those conversations. So, in particular, this is a really great show. It's very important, a very important subject, and we're very glad that we got to view it and be a part of it and discuss it. So here it is, episode 91, The Big Short and the Art of Edutainment. Well, that's why any law in history was ever created, right, Clay? Someone did something dumb.
To keep the people in check, man.
It's the man.
Laws. Politics is about one thing and one thing only, power.
Power. No, so people, I love watching people's reaction to just ridiculous laws. Like, in the city limits, you can't, juggle this many geese, And they're like, why do we have a law? Why did someone take the time to pass this law? And I'm like, we wouldn't have a law for it if someone didn't do it, So anytime you're repulsed by a law or you can't believe someone took the time, just know that at least one person in history did whatever dumb thing that was. Same thing with warning labels and all that good stuff. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Crazy laws usually have a pretty interesting story.
Yeah. But you just have to take time to learn it. And hopefully it's something that they have covered or eventually will cover on Drunk History. Because then it would be even more entertaining.
Then it becomes real.
Because people learn about it. So, and in kind of a weird, funny, comedic way. But speaking of historical comedies or something like that. So we've all come here to talk about a movie that I think did not get advertised very much. At least in far out, you usually hear like, oh, you got your like the 3, 4, or 5 month out trailers, the teasers, and people really know what's coming down the pipe. The Big Short, on the other hand, I remember seeing it listed on release date sites, but I didn't even see advertisements for it until like mid to late November.
So interesting.
You're talking
right at a month out.
I had a completely different experience.
You had Clay, you had a completely different experience. I want to hear about that experience.
I saw the trailer at least 3 or 4 months out, and I was so excited about it from that moment on.
Was it in the theater?
I was telling everybody about it.
Somewhere on the web.
I first saw the trailer in the theater. Lord knows what movie it was, but it had to be pre-October. I'm thinking it was like pretty far out, and I was like, this is amazing. And I was so excited for it. I really anticipated this film.
Well, so you're anticipating a film, and I want to get to this too, especially with you as well, Gene. But The Big Short was written by Adam McKay. So we have a film about a financial crisis. It's, you know, a movie that kind of portends to be very serious in topic, written and directed by, like I said, Adam McKay, who is most famous for doing things like Anchorman and Step Brothers and most other Will Ferrell movies, and most recently Ant-Man. A little picking up Edgar Wright's leaving of that film or firing or however that situation exactly played out. So it's like not who you would have picked. You know, it's not probably the person that you would have thought would handle a financial crisis film, especially with some of the actors involved, considering, like, again, he's mostly working with people like Will Ferrell. He's now working with Ryan Gosling, Christian Bale, Steve Carell, Brad Pitt, et cetera, et cetera. Right. So what was it that excited you, Clay?
I liked the whole vibe, and the cast was the first thing that grabbed my attention because it was just massive cast. I'm a huge fan of Steve Carell, Brad Pitt, and Christian Bale. You know, Ryan Gosling's pretty good too. And just seeing what they were doing, catching that Moneyball vibe, but with more comedy right off the bat, it was all good to me. And it was a topic I didn't realize how well it was going to be handled. Spoiler on how I feel about this movie. however, it was a topic that I recognized as, you know, majorly important too. So, it just looked like a lot of fun, and I was like, it's an ensemble cast that's going to actually have a chance at working well.
Gene, how far out did you know about this film, and what was it that got you to go see it?
I was really more in your boat. It was about 3 or 4 weeks, I feel like, before I kind of started hearing a lot about it, and that was mostly just word of mouth. And I think I sought out the trailer. I didn't catch it in any previews or anything. Mm-hmm. You know, seeing directed by Adam McKay kind of at the end of the trailer for it kind of throws you for a loop when you're watching it, because it seems like they're going to tackle this serious topic, and of course they do. But you got, like Clay was saying, you got this amazing cast of people. Steve Carell is right at the top there. I really like a lot of what Ryan Gosling has done, and knowing that these guys are going to be somehow playing off each other and telling this story was really intriguing. And then to hear it was Adam McKay, it's like, what? Adam McKay? The guy who points the camera at Will Ferrell, right? And so that was the cast alone should draw about anybody in, but then Adam McKay, the curiosity just peaks right there.
Well, and I want to be clear, because I don't want to, like, you know, necessarily dump on Adam McKay, like, oh, he makes terrible movies, why could he?
No.
Well, yeah, I want to be, I think, I would say all of us probably enjoy most of his films. It's more of a surprise that he would be attached to,
yeah,
just like you're saying, Gene, like this topic, you know?
Yeah. Not, and the genre too.
Yeah.
Just total switch of genres and tackling a pretty serious topic that's really recent in everyone's memory.
Well, I don't necessarily know, or I hope everyone's seen the film. I know you guys have, but I hope anyone listening has seen the film, because I think it's definitely worth seeing. But I would say that there probably are people out there, maybe even who have seen the film, that still don't really understand the scope or impact that the global financial crisis had. And I wanted Clay to kind of give some perspective on a movie that has a lot of big words and seemingly near undefinable terms. So, Clay, is there any way that you can kind of put this in context for people if either of you have seen it or getting ready to see it?
Oh, gosh. I think, first of all, you know, while I did teach a lot of history of political science and I had to cover political economy and things like that, I am certainly no economist. So I went in probably with way more knowledge than the average moviegoer, I would say. But I certainly do not position myself as really a scholar, you know, as an expert in these things. And one of the things I love so much about the movie is that it does exactly that. It helps people who go in, forget people who don't know about the crisis, who don't even know what they don't know, like that, you know, who don't even know what a bubble is. And these are really complicated terms. Clearly, there were things in there that I had never heard of, and had certainly never heard them explained so clearly. So what you need to know, I suppose, is almost nothing, because the movie does such a great job of explaining it. Not that I'm copping out. I would say that in 2008 and 9, there was a major financial crisis. You know, people use terms like meltdown, fears of another American Great Depression, like the one that happened in the 1930s when the stock market crashed in 1929. And that was largely based on the failure of the U.S. mortgage market, and that's homes. That's homes that people buy. So there were a lot of bad loans which could not be paid back, which means that the people who received those loans were going to default. That means, you know, their houses are going to be lost. They're going to default on their loans, and for people who were counting on that money, they're supposed to do a better job of knowing that they're going to get the money they've loaned out, for example. Mm-hmm. So as far as, you know, what is uncovered in the system, the movie does a really great job of that. But I can tell you that I was also a home buyer in 2004. And I remember very clearly not knowing a thing about how buying a home worked. And I went to get approved for a mortgage. And what you do is you apply and they give you the amount of money basically that you're approved for. And if you follow the movie, I was buying a house like right there in the middle of the Wild West. Like those two guys who are in the bar, those brokers, yeah. They're just mm-hmm. like, they're just laughing about the system and how ridiculous it is and how much money they're raking in. That's all pretty accurate. So someone like me who figured I would get an $85,000, $105,000 home, perhaps, I get a phone call and they're like, congratulations, you've been approved for $190,000. And I was like, oh, okay. I guess I can get a $200,000 house then, because someone just said they'd give me that money.
Yeah, why would they offer you the money if you couldn't pay it back?
Right, and that's the idea. You know, they were just basically saying like, "So, do you have a name?" You're like, "Yes." "Do you have a job?" "Yes." And they'd be like, "Okay, well, you can have a house." Like, cool. So it's called predatory lending, and it's you know, a lot of you guys probably experienced the same thing when you would walk around a baseball stadium or a college campus in the 90s or early 2000s, and somebody would be like, hey, you want a t-shirt? Sign up for this credit. Mm-hmm. And the next thing you know, you're spending money you don't have. And you know, a lot of those practices have been regulated and refined now as a result of this. But I would say just know that there was a crisis, an economic crisis. It was predicated on the American housing market, and let the movie do its magic, which is what I love so much. It's edutainment at its finest.
Mm, I like that term almost as much as I like the fact that you seemingly incidentally use the term broker, which if you really break it down, the two guys in the film are probably the ultimate brokers.
God.
So...
Do you even broke her?
Exactly. So Gene, when you watched this film the first time, like what struck you more than anything else?
I guess the big thing that struck me first was the method in which McKay chose to explain all this. And that was by the actors breaking the fourth wall and just mm-hmm. talking to you. And when that happened at first, I was like, is this really, okay, this is how we're doing it. All right. And so you're settled into that position, and then it just continues the rest of the movie. That doesn't let up. It's a continual thing that he uses to explain details about this. And then he goes on, not just the characters themselves talking to you, but bringing in these celebrities, and almost it's kind of cool because he it's like he steps outside the movie for a moment. He hits pause on the script, and then he says, all right, here's a difficult part. Let me bring in somebody who can speak normal English to you and describe this in something you're familiar with, you know, playing cards or eating food, slicing it up and what have you. And I thought that was neat, too. So those two things struck me as a really cool technique to explain something that is mind-wreckingly complex. And he just boiled it down really simple, really straightforward. But it's still something that, even thinking back on the explanations, I feel like I need to watch it again to still get a better grasp of it. So
not only are you saying that that technique really worked for you, but would you go that next step, kind of like Clay has already, and say that it does enough for you as a viewer where you don't really have to understand a lot coming into the film because the film is taking care of most of that business?
Yeah, I think so. I would agree with that for the most part. I think you just need to understand we're dealing with the housing market and we're dealing with people that, you know, buy and sell these mortgages. The packaging of the mortgages, how that is done, how they are traded is the most difficult thing. And I'm sure, I would guess 80 to 90% of people don't realize that that happens, you know, after they purchase their mortgage.
Yeah.
That it goes off and it's grouped with however many thousands of other mortgages, and they're given a rating and it's traded ad infinitum until then. Mm-hmm. So that's something that's difficult to grasp from the get-go. But I think if you understand we're dealing with mortgages, so it's inherently difficult to understand, then you're on a good start.
As anyone who's ever tried to work their way through a mortgage has personally found out, right?
Yeah.
But what I love about it is that there's a couple of things that they do by that style of breaking the fourth wall. And one of them is in the opening setup that there is a point at which they are saying to us, Jared Vennett, played by Ryan Gosling, is saying they use big words and complicated language just for this reason, so that you and I can't, so that you can't figure out what they're doing, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like he's our ally. And by talking to him throughout the film, we're almost like complicit. It's almost like we're sucked into like being on the inside of their secret. Yeah. And again, we'll figure out later on if we think they're culpable or not, like if they did anything wrong or they just worked the system. But what it does is it says, you know, we're not going to let them get away with this. Them, right? It projects outward. We're not going to let them get away with this with their complicated language. So then it's like a backhanded compliment. Is like, so here's what you need to understand this. Margot Robbie in a hot tub.
Yeah. You're an idiot. Then, but that's the thing. I mean, they're basically, yeah, it's that backhanded thing. They're on one hand pointing out that financial brokers or whatever, because I don't even know who they are. They're business people. They're banking people, bros, you know, like I don't even know what their titles are.
That'll be the sequel, Bank Bros.
Bank Bros, you know, the big bro, you know, like I don't even know what half these people do. I don't know what half of their job titles are. I don't even necessarily, like I said, know if they do.
Hedge fund managers,
you know, like they basically get paid, or they make more money if they create more ways to make money, like out of nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. And they figure out where to invest money.
Yeah, it's and I love the fact that eventually the movie will come full circle and talk about like fraud, and basically just point out that at some point you're just making stuff up, you know, and you're selling it, and as long as people keep buying it, it works until someone stops. And I think that's what struck me most about the film, especially through this explanation piece, like, I can't believe some of these things exist. Like who thought, I mean, I guess it shows us on occasion, like who thought of some of these things. But it's weird to think that there was a dude like sitting at a desk one day and he said, I'm going to package a whole bunch of these mortgages and it's going to make sense. Somehow the dollars and cents will make sense. And that just kind of weirds me out. But when we talk about how the film was made, June, I know you spent a good little bit of time talking about the things that you liked about what they did, but I saw that a few critics kind of knocked on the film. or at least they try to knock it back down to earth a little bit, because they said that it's a comedy that realizes about halfway through that it should have been a documentary. And I'm not sure I necessarily agree with that. But Clay, does that kind of strike you as true, or is the tone maybe too uneven to really get the message that they're trying to send through? Like, did the comedy take away from it? Did the should it have been a documentary?
No, we have a lot of documentaries, and guess what? People don't watch them. Mm-hmm. I get excited about PBS Frontline. Apparently, that's not a normal thing. I describe this movie as a horror comedy without zombies or slashing knives, and that's what I stand by.
Yeah,
it's terrifying. It's so disturbing.
Yeah. It's a little bit tragic. I mean, I suppose I see where they're coming from, that they're documenting things that happened and how this came about and who saw it coming and all that. So in a sense, it's part documentary, but it's more of a comedy, drama, tragedy, especially by the end of it. You know, the second half really starts to nail you, where you were coming along with it and you were laughing along with these guys and you're enjoying the little moments where these celebrities are talking to you like you're, you know, a second grader. but then by the end of it, you're really hit home with the fraudulent and the moral repercussions of everything you've just watched. And it starts to really nail you. And then it becomes, man, how did this ever happen? This is tragic.
Mm-hmm. See, it's the perfect tone though, right? It's like the roaring 20s, the 1920s, the jazz age. It was like the party's never going to stop. It was so much fun and frivolity. And then all of a sudden one day they turned around and all their money was gone and their lives were ruined.
Mm.
And this movie, the actual pace of the movie mirrors the decade of disaster that it really covers, really the 6 years. Like from 2003, 4, really from the late 90s on, I mean, it was just like sky's the limit. Mm-hmm. You got douchey brokers who are just in the bar and it's like all good. It's never going to stop. But then all of a sudden, like the party comes to a screeching halt. And that's that moment in the restaurant in Las Vegas where Steve Carell's sitting listening to the guy who handles the accounts for the executives explaining how fraudulent the CDO system is. And from that moment on, you're like, whoa.
Yeah, it's not funny.
That's it.
Like, the movie is still technically funny, but like the situation is no longer funny.
And that's
funny.
Reality. That's how reality worked in this exact case. So that's why I thought it was a brilliant parallel.
Well, that goes back to, I think, this amazing term that I don't think you invented, but you have definitely pushed so far, which is edutainment. I wanted to push back against people who kind of laid this claim against the film, that its tone was so uneven that maybe even Adam McKay didn't know what he was trying to make. And I have a really hard time believing that. I was like, I think he knows exactly what he's doing. And I think that observation, Clay, is really great. It follows that tone. It follows the tone of the people who are realizing what's going on. You know, it is kind of fun in games at first, and it's kind of silly. I mean, tragically silly, but then it really becomes like a horror. You know, it's the town that's carefree, and then, you know, the toxic ooze spills, and then once people realize the toxic ooze is turning people into zombies, it's not a carefree city anymore. Like, people are running for their lives. People are dying, you know. And I would say, I would also echo basically what you were saying, which is, they have made a lot of documentaries about the financial crisis. They've probably made endless or countless, you know, documentaries about this specific thing, about each piece of this specific thing, drilling down into almost every single one of these things. And some of them have been recognized for awards, but that doesn't mean people have seen them.
Right.
That doesn't mean your average, you know, your average Joe on the street that needs, you know, Margot Robbie drinking, you know, champagne or whatever in a bubble bath has seen this this kind of financial crisis broken down. We hear terms a lot of time thrown about like, oh, the bank bailouts and stuff, like, that's bad because I heard someone tell me it was bad once because that's my money, but they don't really understand why or why the banks were bailed out or if it was really that good or bad or what led to it or what led to the leading to it. and without this edutainment, for good or bad. Because, you know, I do think, you know, people should be a little more excited about, you know, watching PBS, you know, it's
well, to keep carrying that contrast, I was trying to think, I mean, Wolf of Wall Street is a very clear comparison to this type of tone, and dealing with the same topic. I was trying to think of others, and my mind kept going back to, Ben Stein on Ferris Bueller. Do you guys remember when at the very beginning of that movie, he's explaining depression era economic decisions to the classroom?
Yeah.
And everybody's falling asleep because number one, it's he's telling it a boring way. And
something two, economics.
Stein. Yeah.
Something. Economics.
Voodoo
economics.
But it's boring and everybody's falling asleep. And this is not that. This is a fun way to tell it. But still hits home. And I never once got the feeling that Adam McKay didn't have complete control over what he wanted to tell, the story he wanted to tell and the way he wanted to tell it.
Yeah.
I felt like he knew exactly what he wanted to do. He wanted to pull us in, make us feel comfortable in understanding all this, and then just hit it over the head and say, wow, this is serious.
Well, I don't suppose either of you have actually read the book by Michael Lewis, have you?
I have not.
Okay. I just want to make sure we're all on the same page. And by page, I mean, we didn't pick up the book. So, because I'm curious what the actual tone of Michael Lewis's book, was. So if anyone out there listening has read the book, I would love for you to comment and let us know if, Adam McKay used a lot of the information or, you know, Lewis's book was more or less in this tone, like it had some of the outrageous parts, or as you know, Gene, kind of you're pointing out, it does kind of have at times a Wolf of Wall Street feel, though obviously this one pulls back and says this is ridiculous and wrong, whereas the Wolf of Wall Street basically just keeps giving you ridiculousness, and hopefully you'll get the fact that it's making fun of these people.
Yeah, look, excess. Look at how gratuitous we are with it. It's a different thing, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so the ultimate goals of both these films are very different. Actually, without the comedy aspects, and Gene, I know you said you haven't had a chance to see this yet, and I don't know about what you've had a chance to see yet, Clay, but actually this reminds me of Spotlight more than anything.
I was gonna bring that up.
Yeah, I was gonna say it reminds me of a film that I would say needs to be seen. But falls under edutainment. Like, it's not a documentary. You know, Spotlight is not a documentary about this terrible thing that happened. But, you know, it's dramatized. It's got an ensemble cast that does a really amazing job. But
does it work in some comedy and things?
But it's not funny.
Okay.
But I would still say it's edutainment because it's still dramatized, you know, historical events.
Yeah, I mean, a scandal on this level with a religious institution isn't as academic as economics, but Spotlight was very wise, like in the way that it's handled. It doesn't flinch, but it also somehow it keeps the tone bearable. So it gives you these moments of painful reality. Mm-hmm. But I need to watch Spotlight again and formulate my thoughts on that one more. But there's something else to it that it manages to find that balance where you don't feel like you've just been pummeled, but you've also learned, and it's given you a window into a topic that you might not otherwise be able to look. And it's not unlike Life is Beautiful with Roberto Benigni. You know, there's a lot of movies on the Holocaust, but then all of a sudden you've got this guy who says, what if we have a movie that starts off as like Laurel and Hardy madcap and is on its way to a concentration camp, and then it keeps the comedy up inside the concentration camp. Like, that was so risky, and it was either going to ruin his career or do what it did and win him the Academy Award in, like, you know, 100 different countries.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of risks when you take such a serious subject, and obviously the loss of life and genocide is a whole other level beyond a financial crisis that had a great human impact. But it's that same idea, right, that – same thing with the sex abuse scandal. They didn't use comedy, but they definitely came at it in a very unique way, and it worked. And when it works, it's so powerful because it does pull in the audience and it raises awareness like no other medium in the world can besides movies.
Yeah. It's like if investment bankers steal all your money and no one's around to hear about it, did it actually happen? There's this idea that if you can't draw someone in long enough to tell them the story, does your story actually matter? This is something we would see, or I could relate to, you know, as a preteen being dragged to church, you know, by my mom, being like, look, it's so boring. I don't even care what the story is. At least, you know, at the time. And fortunately, there's been lots of great ways to tell the story since, and it has been a lot more compelling and impactful. But I would say, you know, if you can't get someone's attention long enough to tell them the story, then sadly, I feel like the content doesn't matter.
And by the way, this is why The Great Dictator, Charlie Chaplin's Great Dictator, is such a legendary film, like political satire, comedy, drama. Mm-hmm. You talk about like jam packing the genres.
Yeah.
And by the way, he was doing that before America was even in the war. And he was, you know, he was British, but there's probably somebody on this McKay Randolph team that, you know, was thinking through, when has this kind of thing been done?
Mm. Well, I would say too, I still like I think recommending The Dictator, people who like multiple genre things, great film. I think people who appreciated what this film was trying, what The Big Short was trying to do, will appreciate Spotlight. And at least at the time we're recording this one, we have already recorded our episode on Spotlight and had a pretty amazing conversation on it. I have no idea when any of these are going to release.
You're just piling them all up.
I'm just piling them all up, man. If you're listening to this now and you haven't seen Spotlight, then I would suggest maybe giving that a shot too. Because I think it's not going to be humorous, but it's going to be enlightening, and it's going to do it in a way that's engaging. And then you can listen to that episode too, because it's really good. Just like this one's already.
Did you guys talk at all about doubt in that podcast?
A little bit. I had my pastor on, and we had a talk about like kind of what place the church has in those type of situations. But I want to ruin
it. Yeah, that's what I've been.
So.
No, yeah, that's what I've been most interested in is kind of contrasting Spotlight whenever I get to see it with Doubt, because I really like Doubt, mm-hmm. and so I'm hoping there's a lot of good meat there.
Mm. Well, I'll forward this conversation about The Big Short on by asking this question, and maybe it's a more of a meta question, and you can kind of interpret it however you'd like, but Gene, would you say that it's really that hard to believe? And maybe this is a leading question, that the global financial crisis really got as bad as it did. Is it really that hard to believe?
In some levels, I think it is, because if you just look at, you know, the way the movie presented it and taking us step by step through how these decisions are made. And I found myself multiple times just thinking, who in the world thought this was a good idea? Like, why is this a smart financial decision? You're going to lose money. It seems obvious just looking at it, you know, hindsight's 20/20.
Mm-hmm.
But then you consider these are all people who, Clay, I think you said before, these are all people who are trying to, the more money they can make for others is more money for themselves. So any way they can package something, any way they can spend something to make it seem better than it actually is in order to sell it, then they're going to make money. So when you know that that's the goal, then it's not surprising that you get people or lots of people go to some pretty extreme lengths to make that dollar. So, you know, at the very base of it, the ones and twos of it, it seems like this is stupid. Why would anyone ever do this? But knowing a motivation of greed and, I don't think it's too hard to imagine. I mean, mankind has done much more terrible things than rip people off of their money. So it's not outside the scope of reality.
Mm.
Well, again, and the movie does, answer that question. Like, how did this happen? Why do they think they could get away with this? And when Steve Carell's character is having his kind of big epiphany through the final part there, He says it. He's like, you knew they knew this was going to happen, and they knew they were going to get bailed out because the finance industry is the biggest interest group in America.
Too big to fail.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah. And so I wrote that question out, and then I had to kind of figure out what I wanted to add to the conversation. And all I could think to write was humanity, y'all. You know, like, I mean, I think that's, it's what frustrates me most when people tell me about, like, the inherent goodness of people and how, you know, it was what I was afraid about The Martian, you know, because the trailers for The Martian were like, you know, they're basically everyone's ready to do the right thing all the time. And I'm like, I don't feel like you've, like, looked at even recent history, much less, like, long ago history, to see what the basic motivations of the human heart are. Yeah. And, you know, are there positive decisions people have made in history? Yes. But overall, most of the calamity, you know, most of the as Gene, you said, the worst things in a financial crisis that humanity have ever done, it's all, I mean, because we're jacked up. I mean, we're selfish, you know?
Yeah, what's worse, it seems like when people do good things, it's on a microscopic level. You know, you're doing it personally for one person or two other people, or, you know, small relational type things like that. But when people do bad things, it's on a massive scale. It's on a national scale. It's countries against countries. And our true motivation in many cases our true desires is shown out through that. And how we, what we allow to happen right under our nose, because it's going to get us this or that, you know. And we might say, well, it's not our fault. We didn't do anything directly. I'm just trying to make a dollar. I'm just trying to sell my product. And we keep in that mindset, and we don't step back to say, hey, this is really terrible. This is really bad.
Mm. Well, I like if you take that a step further too, and we really look at arguments that people would make that say, you know, it may be if everyone just did good, the world would be a better place, and it's, you know, loosely defined. Yeah. I don't mean to be too condescending about it, but it does seem so simple that it almost, like I said, it doesn't really make a lot of sense to me, because when you can start making excuses, like, how do you start defining good outside of your own self?
Sure.
Without exactly. Some other way to define good, because, you know, what do you mean what do you mean I hurt this person? I'm just trying to make, you know, a dollar so I can feed my family. How is that not good? Oh, well, somewhere down the line that you made that dollar, someone was exploited.
Right.
So how can we do good in all things, in every situation, by our own definition, you know?
Well, yeah. And popular stories also tell you how the stories that a culture wants to tell about itself, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, the Martian example is one where we want to believe that's who we are, that everybody comes together and makes those good things. Or if we're watching a story about something dark and criminal, most of us want to see how we are somehow innocent or, you know, at least more heroic in the story than not, or more closely related to whoever the story's protagonist is.
Yeah, so, we wouldn't be the bad guy.
Yeah, we never are, right?
We wouldn't be Jared Vinette in this story. We wouldn't be him. We'd want to be Mark Baum, Steve Carell's character. We'd want to be the guy who's searching for truth, who can't believe that this could possibly happen, and he's going out and he's interviewing people. But even then, I mean, he's the guy we all want to be in this movie. He's carrying the emotional weight of this film. But even then, he is still investing in the failure of the system. He's still benefiting from it. So he's still got, you know, one foot in the dirty water and one foot in the good. So
he says all along, I've been trying to figure out who we were betting against, and it was you. It was Morgan Stanley who he worked for.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah.
Well, and that's what I wanted to ask. I mean, one of the things I like about the film is that there are a lot of gray lines. There are not a lot of black and white lines. I mean, there are some, you know, like some people are just doing terrible things, but lots of times I'm just not thinking about it. And when you have a movie that kind of lives in the gray so much, I wonder, like, is there a moral compass in the film? Is there a character that is the protagonist? Is there, you know, is there anybody who we can point to that we actually do want to be?
Is there a moral compass in American political life and high finance?
Boom!
I mean, is it an accurate reflection, or is it? I mean, it would have been less it would have been less believable if Atticus Finch would have been, you know, in the story. You know.
Wait, which version? Like the
Gregory Peck's.
Yeah.
I mean, this is not going to be Mr. Smith showing up to tell us about, you know, shorting the housing market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is not Jimmy Stewart's world, because that world doesn't exist.
Yeah.
We don't believe it can anymore. So we get these stories, which are the reflection of the gray world in which we live.
Mm.
You know, one thing I noticed about Mark Baum in this movie, and you guys tell me if you picked up on this, at the beginning, he is distrustful of everything. I got the sense he was kind of a conspiracy theory kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
He's selfish. I mean, he's everything revolves around him. And when he hears about this, these credit swaps, he doesn't believe it at first, and he goes on this, you know, fact finding mission. And I think he starts to become a bit of a whistleblower at the end, because he sits down and he has this debate with, I'm spacing on names now, but he's debating this other guy who represents, you know, these big banks who are making these terrible packaging of these mortgages and these CDOs. He represents them, and Mark Baum represents the one trying to scream the truth from the mountaintop. So he kind of becomes that at the end. He kind of becomes that guy who is trying to shine light on this whole system, and he's, mm-hmm. you know, he says it's going to blow up in your face. So he kind of becomes that. But again, he's still invested.
Yeah, I was going to say, but he's still profiting. So
yeah,
he's still straddling that line, 1 foot on both shores.
Well, but he's also, I mean, his character views it as predatorial against them. He's going to profit, and the whole guilt complex that he just doesn't sell up until the very last second when his guys are finally like, you have to sell.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
He knows when he walks away from these guys, like, they might be smug, but they're going to lose like real bad.
Mm-hmm.
And so when he makes those bets, he knows that it's their money that he's going to end up with. Well, he thinks, right? He doesn't know that it's going to be, you know, Morgan Stanley's mm-hmm. failure as well. And right. he starts to get a glimmer of that. So he's trying to punish them as well. And will he benefit? Yeah, if he sells. And that's why we're kind of shown him, you know, really struggling with that.
Mm.
Yeah.
So how do you both feel about Ben Rickert, like Brad Pitt's character?
Mm.
It's Rusty from Ocean's 11. when he dresses up as a doctor and goes in to save Abe. It's the exact same character.
But on a morality level.
I feel like Brad Pitt's the only thing Brad Pitt had to do in this movie was deliver that line to his two disciples, mm-hmm. Shipley and Geller, deliver that line to them when they are so excited about what they see on the horizon that they're going to profit so greatly.
Yeah.
And they're kind of high-fiving each other and whatever. And he comes and he says, I wrote it down. He kind of like stops them in their tracks. And he says, if we're right, people lose homes, people lose jobs, people lose retirement savings, people lose pensions. You know what I hate about banking? It reduces people to numbers. So he recognizes all the problems with it. And he is, I wonder if, as he's kind of taking these two guys along with him to get their foot in the door to make all these purchases to be able to profit from this, I wonder if he's kind of trying to show them the evil of the whole industry, the not that it necessarily has to be that way, but it just is that way. It mm-hmm. reduces people to numbers. And he's trying to show them that. And that was the big delivery. That was the one thing that Brad Pitt had to nail.
Yeah.
You know, all his lines, however he looked, he had to nail that line. That had to really hit home with the audience. And you had to see it in Shipley and Geller and their reaction. And I think you do. You see them, they're excited one moment, and then you just see their countenance fall. And they're just heart sunk, and they realize
it was like being scolded by your father.
Oh, it was, yeah.
Yeah. Well, so Clay, what do you see? You know, Brad Pitt's or Rickard's role in the movie as.
You know, I took it at face value that, so he had been in the game and now he's out, but he still has access to the table, and these guys are trying to get it. So, you know, for him, it's like, well. Especially at the outset when he's just investigating this or he's just facilitating a meeting for them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's like that this is the reality in front of me. And if he really does kind of prefer this type of life, and this was based on a real guy, Ben mm-hmm. Rickard is based on a real character who is a recluse basically. And he hasn't even commented on the film, but, yeah, probably, you know, the characters is doing something kind for a couple of up-and-comers. He probably sees something in himself. It's not really consistent with somebody who wanted to be completely out of the game, but he just kind of keeps on going along with them for whatever reason. And it's a kindness to them. So I guess he's a mentor in that way, and he's an advocate in that way. He just kind of figures the system is screwed, and now a lot of people are screwed, but I guess at least I can help these two young guys who are in front of my face.
Mm. Yeah, I was kind of curious too, because he waffled for me. Well, I mean, he didn't necessarily waffle, but my feelings about him waffled, because there was half the time I couldn't tell if he was, you know, trying everything within his power to be out of the game, but it really just, you know, like an addict, it just took that one
yeah.
invite to get back in the game. Why he could still kind of safely say, oh, it's not me, it's for these guys. Or was kind of like Gene, like you know, you kind of offered that he saw, well, actually Clay too, a little bit, like he saw something like of himself or a way to help these people who were being shut out of an already unfair game. And he kind of wanted to even the odds, even in his little own way. So it was almost like him getting back at the system by using
yeah.
his previous power to kind of balance the scales. So it never really landed either way. But I think, Gene, what you said about him, like needing to be there, kind of the story needing to be told about him apprenticing and then bringing some reality in was pretty crucial, whatever his motivations truly were.
Yeah, and you almost wonder, the movie doesn't really elaborate much on him, but you almost wonder if he doesn't feel, you know, regret or anything about taking part in that.
Yeah.
I mean, it would have happened whether he's involved or not, just these two guys wouldn't have benefited from it, but you almost wonder if, you know, his interest has peaked and he gets back in it and he's leading these two along and then he kind of realizes, and maybe that comment is as much to himself as to those two, just realizing once again what this business and what this industry does to people,
mm-hmm.
Reducing them to numbers and taking away. I think it was Christian Bale's character towards the end. This industry takes away everything that makes you care, everything that brings emotion to you. He's kind of an open end. You wonder how he feels about it.
Hmm. Well, so that kind of leads me to one of the things I was curious about, which is maybe unconventionally, but do we see justice in this film? Like, is there any justice? And if there is, like, what does it look like?
It's fictional. They run us through the montage of everything that happened in coming years.
Yeah.
And then they're like, yeah, if only. No, there's no justice because it's a real story and there's no justice in real life. The banks get bailed out. The brokers at the top. Nobody goes to jail.
Everyone gets bonuses.
I mean, one guy, who by the way is a nationalized American, of course, goes to jail. And that's it. So there's no satisfaction, which is kind of why, same thing with Spotlight. I think this is where it is. For a story that is so truthfully unsatisfying, they found a way to tell it in that it's terrifying, but that you can kind of go back and understand it.
Mm-hmm. Gene, did it seem like there was any kind of justice to you?
No, not at all. If there is any, it's just what I think what the movie tried to accomplish in sort of shining a light in the corners of the industry and saying, look at what these people do, and then look at what the outcome is. They're really no worse off. You know, their names have been dragged through the mud, but for the most part, all these same people or people like them are still running the show.
Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of regulatory changes that happen because of this, and you know, Dodd-Frank in 2010, and a lot of the changes that are still being implemented, like up until recent months, are still happening. There are a lot of changes for sure, and predatory lending has been really undermined. And there are some positive things that are happening to build safeguards into the system. But the one scene that kind of might stand out as, I don't know if it's justice, but because they put us with Dr. Burry for so long, who I think Christian Bale was just as strong as Steve Carell in this movie, mm-hmm. Maybe stronger. I thought that was comparable for me on either way.
Yeah.
We watch this guy go through such hell when the boss comes in and, you know, they just ream him out for being wrong. And you're like, no, this dude knew. Like, he not only did he know, he did his job and he didn't do anything wrong. He just saw a bunch of stupid lenders. He created he created something very clever, these credit swaps, in order to capitalize on a good investment. And when it didn't pay off exactly when he expected, he knew there was something worse going on. So we're kind of put through the ringer with him when he's getting like reamed out and threatened. And mm-hmm. and then all of a sudden he gets that check for like $500 million. And you're like, what?
And he writes up on the board the final percentage, like 439,000%
yeah.
profit.
Yeah. Yeah, because weren't they going to like, they were like estimating like 19 or something like that?
Yeah, yeah. It was like 4 or 5 at the beginning and it just kept going up. Hmm. I did like Christian Bale, and I thought he did a good job of nailing kind of the socially awkwardness of this guy. But at the end, I found myself remembering more about Steve Carell's character, and it could just be because of his tone and his nature and his kind of attacking attitude towards all this that it kind of stuck in my memory more. I was forgetting more about what Michael Burry went through. Like you said, Clay, just getting reamed by his bosses while he just has to sit there and take it. Mm-hmm. I thought that character was kind of passively detached from everything. You know, I'm thinking of these four people, that we're tracking with Michael Burry, Jared Vinette, we haven't talked about much, Mark Baum, and then the two guys, Shipley and Geller, that are under Brad Pitt's wing. But Michael Burry is strangely, I feel like he's a little emotionally detached from everything. Like he recognized, he saw in the numbers what was coming. And he is brilliant when it comes to figuring those things out. But it seems like almost exclusively from a financial perspective is the way he's viewing this. He's not necessarily digging into the effects, the fraud, the truthfulness, the emotional weight of it like mm-hmm. Mark Baum is doing. He's kind of sitting in his office, and not to say that it's easy for him or anything. You notice his rock music getting louder and louder as the movie progresses. And I think that's a metaphor for what's going on in his mind. It's mm-hmm. getting heavier and heavier on him, this burden that he has to bear. And we see that through his interactions with his bosses and the louder music. But I connected more with Baum because like I said, he's carrying more of the emotional weight of this movie, and Burry was more just kind of not really in the background because we got a lot from him, but he was just more detached, I felt like, from the consequences of all of this.
Well, I would put it this way, because I do, when once the movie was directly over, except for the little kind of epilogue about Bury, I felt like he was not in the final act of the film very much, because like I think, like you mentioned, Gene, all the stories that we saw, almost all of them had some kind of moral weight attached to them that we had to work through in the very at the very very end of the movie, and his did not. So his was mostly cut back to him, him dealing with the weight of having other people's money, and dealing with the weight of like him being really really smart and thinking that maybe he made a bad decision or wondering if it's going to come true. But it didn't.
There was a scene. Wasn't there a scene where he's talking? We hear him talk to his wife, right?
Yeah, he had a family. And I do remember that scene that you're talking about, but I don't remember what was said. And if he had a family, I feel like that could have been that could have been shown a little more. I mean, it seems like he's at the office 24/7. What's his wife going through? Does he have? I don't even remember if he had kids or anything.
Well, I didn't think he did, but that was just, you know, an impression. I thought it was just him and his wife.
I get crossed up because I actually read an interview or two with the real Dr. Bury. He's been like totally. I mean, he's around. He's not a mystery. He's not hiding. He just is.
Okay.
You know, he's even talking about water and his investments in that and, and how he views it and everything. So.
Yeah. Okay, so you're getting kind of a more real perspective on him there. I did like his he's the most blunt character, probably next to Baum. He's the most blunt because his emails were great to all of his you know, he's dealing in all these hedge funds, to all his investors. He's just saying, here's what I'm doing with your money, and then that's it. I'm gonna put it all here, and that's it. Have a good day.
Hope you like it. The end. Yeah. just briefly back to the justice thing, did no one think there was even like a smidgen of justice when we got to watch the predatory lender or Schmidt from New Girl have to like go to a job fair there at the end? Was there a little bit of recompense that?
You know, I was working at job fairs at that time, so I was actually doing a resume writing business, and I remember, I mean, in Pittsburgh, the airline industry went first after 9/11. US Air was a hub there, and then it was a lot of people in finance and mortgage. But yeah, that's pretty pretty poignant, I guess. It's a real comeuppance because they delivered those two guys were delivered in a way that really showed them as kind of the worst of the system, but they were just playing the system. And quite frankly, I mean, brokers are still able to do make a lot of money, and it was the system. You know, we don't really see the government officials get that kind of comeuppance because they didn't. So that's kind of the best that they can do, I suppose.
Mm. So, I guess the final question I have, not the final chance to say something, I would say, but the final question I have is, will this happen again?
Yeah.
Is mankind greedy? It'll happen at some level.
Yeah.
The boom bust cycle, bubbles have existed. I mean, you go back, you know, here's my historian cap, but, you know, mercantilism, the alliances of government and businessmen that goes back a few hundred years, the second that existed, we started to have the potential for bubbles. And you can actually look up on Wikipedia, the tulip bubble. When all of a sudden people were speculating on tulips, and this became the big thing, and everybody was buying up tulips because it was like the can't miss bet. It was the .com of the 1600s or whatever.
Well, that immediately followed by the Calvinism bubble, so that's understandable.
Yeah, probably bad enough.
Tulip jokes are funny.
Yeah, so it's been around forever. It's been stocks. It's been .coms. It's been homes. It's just what we do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like your mention of government getting involved with, like, especially the finance industry and really any kind of economic industry. There's, you kind of understand some level of involvement, and you wonder how much is too much or how little is too little. And the one of the interesting things about this movie is I feel like all the fault was laid at the bankers, predatory lending. And that's, I'm not saying that's wrong, that they're definitely at fault. And I think you see McKay's vision of it, his view of it, shine out through portraying everything that way. But mm-hmm. we didn't see anything about, you know, government laxing the allowances for giving out these kinds of loans. We didn't see people like, well, there was one scene where Baum is in a strip club and he's talking to the stripper and she owns five homes for some mm-hmm. reason. And it's like, don't you know you can't afford five homes? so that I think there's blame across the board. And because there are so many people involved that can make horrible decisions and throw huge wrenches in things that should be pretty straightforward, it can absolutely happen again. I mean, that we are going to look for, mankind is going to look for any way to gain an edge over someone else or gain an edge over a system, to get their foot in the door, to gain power for themselves. And it's a proven fact of history. We're going to bend and break the rules to be able to do that. So it'll happen again, and who knows what the next sector or whatever.
And it's super easy to do in America. I mean, mm-hmm. and by the way, it wasn't just Michael Burry and these people that saw this coming. There were many people who were talking about the problems we were going to have with the mortgage industry like 10 years out from when it actually happened. But the reality is that these businesses and banks are regulated by laws. The laws are created by politicians, and the politicians are elected through money. So one, the whole system is screwed, you know, because of the reality of money. The options we ever get are never real true options. They're just whatever options we've been allowed to have without, like, you know, 99% of the population having a say. And honestly, you can be a lawmaker, you can pass legislation, you can write specific language into laws that dictates how private companies must operate, and then you can leave office and go work for a company that benefits yeah. from a law that you just wrote. Mm-hmm. And that's yeah. just how American government works. And as long as that's the reality, yeah, it's gonna always keep happening. But you know, we've been bailing each other out around the planet for the last 20 years. And there's been Asian countries, European countries continue to make decisions that lead to financial apocalypse. And then the rest of the world bails them out. And now, you know, China's sneezing, so the rest of the world's getting a pretty bad financial flu. And now a lot of these folks are really terrified, because if China's in trouble, whoa, that's like saying if America's in trouble in the 1920s or 30s. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we can bail each other out until we can't. And when that happens, then you've got a bigger story than a hiccup that cost a lot of people suffering for a few years.
Mm. Yeah, because once you get it on that scale, then you have nearly everyone in a position where they have next to nothing, and you get to watch what people will really do to preserve not just their power and comfort, but their life.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the takeaways is just, you know, choose what's real. Stocks, if you have the funds and you can play within intangibles and you can buy things that are pieces of paper that are called valuable, great. But if you're a regular person like us and you got to buy a house or a car, or you got to get a credit card, or you want like an Xbox, just know, you know, especially for millennials who didn't live through even the last 10, 20 years, mm-hmm. who weren't buying houses in 2004, just know that even if authority figures with fancy suits and paperwork tell us things, we need to check it out and make sure that we're not going to get hurt.
Yeah. Or at least do everything reasonably within our power to not put ourselves in a position to get hurt.
Yeah, the old adage, man, if it sounds too good to be true, like,
it probably,
you know,
is.
Mm. Young married Clay being told he can have a $200,000 house, probably he shouldn't get a $200,000 house.
Mm. That's hilarious. There's a commercial on TV just earlier today where some lady saying she got this huge TV for $4.99 on, you know, DealDash.com or whatever. And my son is standing there. He goes, $4.99? And I'm like, listen, hold on. If it sounds too good to be true, yeah, it probably is. That's except, so funny you mentioned that.
Except for Salvation.
Which... Hey.
Jesus, Juke. But you know what?
This is a theology podcast.
This movie is, in fact, a good thing to point people to, right? So because young people, I mean, we're only getting older. Each one of us is going to probably have another birthday this year. So when we end up being those, like, you know, cynical middle-aged people who are like, it's too good to be true. And like some, you know, beautiful young college students, like, you know, these young guys and girls that like have the whole world and are just like we were 10, 20 years ago. Could be like, watch The Big Short at least. Like, maybe that's the best I can do to make you believe it. Maybe a Brad Pitt. Yeah. Maybe Ryan Gosling says it, you'll believe it.
Yeah, edutainment, millennials.
And I don't say that condescendingly at all. Like, I walked in and was just as educated, mm-hmm. and I made way more mistakes than most of the college students that I had taught and I meet today mm-hmm. are making. Like, I was way more naive. So it's a good lesson this movie is to
yes, it is
to not facts. Be. Well, I feel like we almost like skipped to our final thoughts, but I do want to make sure we do a little critical look at the movie. So with that, we do our come on moments, the things that maybe didn't sit right with you, something that was off or you thought could be done better. So, Gene, what struck you as like your come on moment?
Yeah, I tried thinking of a. Something that the film was doing, a technique that he was using that I didn't think worked. And I really can't think of much that didn't work. The only thing I came up with was one scene that I personally didn't like. That was the strip club scene. And that was more thinking that it was Adam McKay's kind of sophomoric comedy coming through that we're used to in, you know, Talladega Nights or something. Mm-hmm. And I didn't feel like it was really necessary. And it, you know, I say me personally, I'm more, sensitive to those kinds of scenes where there's nudity or something like that. So to me, it kind of took me out of the film a little bit, and I'm kind of like, okay, we're in a strip club now. Prepare yourself for what you're going to see. But that's not necessarily anything technically wrong with the film. It's just my personal thing going there. But I don't know if I'd even say come on to that. So I don't know if I really have a true come on moment.
Well, I think that's still fair. And I think that works. So,
good.
Excellent. So Clay, same question.
I mean, at face value, the biggest come on moment was when, you know, Mark Baum realizes just how bad it is. Like, this is seriously happening. Like, this is seriously a thing that mm-hmm. there's that side of it, but that's not against the movie.
Against the movie, yeah.
I guess, you know, are we talking about stupidity or evil is one of the things that the movie kind of asks us. You know, is this just ignorance or is this willful arrogance and malice? And I guess if we are asked to just believe that these savvy investors who were following for 2 hours are not complicit, I guess there's a little bit of risk in the end. And we've all kind of expressed that, like our discomfort with just seeing them as protagonists, right? They're not mm-hmm. Mr. Smith going to Washington. They're just kind of guys who point to a higher evil.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I you know, part of me is like, can I say this movie oversimplified the matter? I don't think so. I think it helped explain the matter. Is there an opposing argument to this? Yeah, I've heard it my whole life. I know what Wall Street says about this movie. I know what Big Finance says about this movie and why they're not happy and they think that it vilifies the financial sector and all that. I just disagree with their assessment. That would be their come on moment. So, you know, I didn't catch it taking any political pot shots that I can recall. It didn't go out of its way to just like sideswipe, you know, George W. Bush and not the Democrats, or to just sideswipe Democrats and not Republicans. So I think it was it seemed by my recall to be equal opportunity and its political critique. And that's usually one thing that drives me crazy, is when a complex issue is pointed at just one side. So if on further review it did that, then I would say that. If it didn't, as my memory tells me, then I don't have a huge "Oh, come on" movie. And I think it's rightly rewarded with a nomination for Best Picture, even though I don't think it will or should win.
Oh yeah.
I definitely am really happy to see it up there.
Yeah. So that's, I'm pretty sure that you basically hit on the out of the box kind of come on moment idea that I was going to try to hit on, which was, you know, there were plenty of come on moments during this movie, but they weren't because the movie was doing anything wrong.
Right.
They were because the movie was doing things right.
Yeah.
You
were kind of saying that along with the characters.
Yeah.
Like, come on.
You know, really? Yeah. So I thought I was going to be novel, but like I said, I think Clay's already kind of hit on it. You know, great minds, I'm assuming. That,
of course.
That, you know, when I wrote down my come on moments, it's just those little moments of revelation that we get where, like, you the movie's leading you up to a place and you're like, it can't be that bad. I mean, like, even on this side of history, it couldn't have been that bad. And I think that's the place where the frustration hits, the disbelief. Like, we're already looking back on the situation with hindsight, being, you know, 2020, and it's still fuzzy to believe it happened the way it did. So, those moments, like, you know, Steve Carell's character sitting there talking to the guy who's explaining how great of a deal it is and who's more important, you know, and who makes more money, and just, like, come on, this is terrible. Yeah. How do these people exist? Like, how do they sleep at night? But, so again, we switch gears, kind of.
Hold on, let me squeeze in, Mikey.
Squeeze.
So I had forgotten about this until I read a couple of reviews. I had totally forgotten that Marissa Tomei is in this movie. So if there's the come on, if I postscript come on moment here, it's that Marissa Tomei is underused. So that's my only one.
Come on.
Not a film that passes the Bechdel test, but, you know, then again, the more that are involved, I guess, the more they're going to be vilified in this particular role.
Yeah, well.
Well, so I was going to say, I think that in and of itself is another point that the movie can make. You know, most movies don't pass the Bechdel test out of, like, ignorance or laziness. But this one doesn't pass it, and it not passing is actually more indictment of the time of what was going on.
Yeah, you know? who's in power? Who's in charge?
Yeah, who's in
right?
power? Like, it's the rich white dudes. Yep, bunch of rich white men. You don't see women anywhere. You barely see minorities of any flavor. It's almost all rich white dudes. So, it, like I said, I think it actually works in its favor that it doesn't pass the Bechdel test. It just adds to the argument. But, all right, so Gene, what is your favorite moment then? Or what is some of your favorite stuff about the movie?
One of my favorite things about the movie was Ryan Gosling. Mm-hmm. And we didn't talk about him too much, but I loved his aggressiveness in every one of his scenes that he was in. And
unapologetic.
One in particular, he's getting a call. I think he's talking to Mark Baum or one of Baum's coworkers there. But he's in a bathroom, and he takes the phone call, and he's going into this bathroom, and there's a guy standing there at the sink washing his hands, and he kind of puts his hand over the phone. He's like, "Can you leave? Can you just get out of here? Just go." And he, like, kicks him out, and he leaves. And so then he goes on ranting on the phone with Baum, and he makes the sale and he's all excited, and then he hangs up and you hear a toilet flush and a guy walks out of the stall. He's like, "What did you hear? What did you hear?" I loved his aggressiveness, and I thought it came out really well in that scene. Even after he gets the sale, he doesn't want anyone else in on this. He wants it all for himself, and he's just, like, pushing out people that are even in his own company. These are his coworkers.
Mm-hmm.
So I liked Ryan Gosling a lot in this movie.
Yeah, I guess he was good. I certainly like Gosling. I don't have anything against him. I just didn't think he was as strong as the other guys. But upon further review, like if I watch it again, I really enjoyed every time he was on the screen. So he actually is really key in explaining how the rating systems work and everything.
Right. He's kind of the main narrator.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. That was pretty good. The whole scene, the Jenga tower scene was awesome.
There was a minority in that scene.
You know, I grew up, guys. I grew up on the Muppets, and I grew up on characters breaking the fourth wall. And Bugs Bunny did it, and Kermit did it. And as I've gotten into adult films, I enjoy it when everybody does it. You know, and I've never seen anything like this. I've never seen cameos to completely cut away and explain complicated things like this before. I said in my review, the closest thing I could think of is Woody Allen pulling Marshall McLuhan out of nowhere in the movie lobby in Annie Hall. And, you know, this pretentious movie snob's behind him just like ranting and railing. And he's like, I teach film at New York. I think I know. And Marshall McLuhan would say blah, blah, blah. But it was really clever. And I was just struck by the whole tone, by the way it worked, because you know, Michael Lewis is a great writer, and he wrote Blindside, which was awarded. He wrote Moneyball, which I think is great. So his stuff is adaptable in a pretty significant way. And so for me, it was like, it was the willingness of someone like McKay to go at the film as a director this way. He didn't write this. He adapted this book, you know, with another guy. But it was like the weird interspersed like rap video montages, the way they moved the story along. I don't know if you noticed, it seemed like every time they moved into a new year, they gave us like a montage and like a rap video style of like the technology that was coming out that year and the things that were pop culture iconic that year. Mm-hmm. I thought that was a real clever way to advance the story. So that's what worked for me, telling this story through this mashup genre.
Yeah. And we talked a lot about that at the beginning of the show, too, about how it is different. It's different than most anything that we've seen, and it's even more surprising that Adam McKay was able to pull it off, and that he was the one that was given the chance to do it. So...
And by the way, if people are actually interested in like straight up documentaries, there's good ones out there. Just check out PBS. I know they did that one years ago called Inside the Meltdown. That's PBS Frontline. And there's a newer one I haven't watched in the last couple of years called The Untouchables. But it's an hour documentary. It's online. You could see like who are these guys and why didn't any of them go to jail? Like what is like investigative journalism straight up show us about this?
I would say maybe with a little bit of caution. Because I can't imagine you watching any of those and not just being even more infuriated. So, you know, depending on what kind of mood you want to be in that day.
I'm glad that I gave a couple weeks between The Big Short and Making a Murderer on Netflix, because my blood pressure's going to skyrocket.
I was like, I'm done. I'm done with everything. Oh,
freaking America.
Oh, gosh. So, I guess I'll keep this pretty quick. I think my favorite thing about the movie was Christian Bale's character, and I didn't think we were going to get to really talk about him that much, because, like I said, he didn't have that moral revelation at the end. But I love the way that he figured things out and was quirky, and I thought, kind of like Clay, you've mentioned, like, I thought he was equally as strong as Steve Carell. But to kind of counter that, I also think one of the most... not necessarily edge of my seat, but one of the ones I was most dialed in on was the scene where Baum gets up there to debate the other guy, or to have the discussion with the other guy, who's buying stock in that company, and he just goes off, and he's so random, and he's obviously being really, really socially awkward, but by the end of his speech, it's pretty. Pretty obvious that he's right. So, because of all the texts that are being everyone on their Blackberries on their Crackberries. So that specific scene, and then just Christian Bale's character, those are probably my favorite part of the film. And I'm I kind of understand why both of them have been nominated for various awards for both their performances. So, all right. Clay, do you have any final thoughts that you want to throw out there before we wrap up?
That was kind of what was my final thought, I guess, that mm-hmm. it's worth continuing to mm-hmm. find out more about the story.
Yeah, I would agree. Actually, if you send me some of those titles, then I'll make sure they're in the show notes too, so people can look them up.
Okay.
Just to give you more work to do. Gene, same thing. Any final thoughts that you want to leave people with?
Yeah, I mean, obviously greed is sort of one of the central themes mm-hmm. In this whole movie, and there's no shortage of scripture talking about greed, you know, money, having a lust for money and that type of thing. But I found a couple of verses in the 10th Psalm that I think pull together the idea of greed and also how you're using your greed to treat other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was kind of perfect. The 10th Psalm, verses 2-4, says, "In pride the wicked hotly pursue the afflicted. Let them be caught in the plots which they have devised. For the wicked boasts of his heart's desire, and the greedy man curses and spurns the Lord. The wicked, in the haughtiness of his countenance, does not seek him. All his thoughts are, there is no God." And the first part there, "Pride of the wicked hotly pursue the afflicted," I thought that really captured the attitudes that that all these bankers have about mm-hmm. they are pursuing money. They're pursuing the dollar in such a way that they are afflicting other people. They're creating victims out of other people through the predatory lending, through lying to them and saying, you know, you can afford this much, when in actuality there's no way they could.
Yeah.
And then where it says, "Let them be caught in the plots which they have devised," I thought that was perfect too. I mean, they're putting this system together that is doomed to fail, and they're caught in it. So I thought that verse, those couple of verses there, really spoke to the general attitude that the movie plays a part in exposing, especially through the interview where Baum was talking with that guy at the casino tables, and he's just going on and on about how he packages these things, and Baum leaves the table and he says, "I want you to short everything that guy has touched." And that just nails it right there. These mm. people are just wicked and beyond imagination.
Yeah. Well, I also like the part of that basically, I don't remember exactly what the phrasing is, but it's basically like they're living like there is no God. And I think that gets to the heart of why all these things happen, in the faults in humanity that we've kind of woven in and out of this talk about in this podcast. Because if you don't believe in a God, then you're trying to find your own security. You have, it actually makes more sense for you to try to make as much money and as possible, to get as much power and comfort as you can, if there is no God. So sometimes it's hard for me to fault people for doing things like this, because I'm like, well, actually, you're just being really honest to what you believe. You know, so on one hand, you know, you're a terrible person. On the other, kudos to you for living what you believe. You know, it's like you almost have to be impressed. But outside of that, I would say my final thought is, I think this is the best kind of edutainment. I remember at the beginning of this episode, and someone else told me that they said they really wanted to see it again, because everything in this film comes at you so fast. Even though they try to explain everything to you, you're still not going to get everything. You're not going to understand every single thing that happened. And, you know, so people were like, I feel like I just need to watch it again. And while I completely commend watching it multiple times, again, depending on what kind of mood you want to be in for that day or that week or whatever, I don't think you need to watch it to try to 100% understand. So I think it does a good job of conveying what it needs to the first time you watch it. Like I said, you're welcome to watch it again. I would like commend it to watch it again, because I think it's a really good film. But because I've noticed the further I get from it, the more I do want to see it again. Maybe because I'm a masochist, I don't know. But it's just been a surprise. Because I thought it was flying, like I mentioned at the beginning, I thought it was kind of flying under the radar because maybe it wasn't as strong as some people had hoped it would have been when they cast it. But I was glad to see that it was reviewed well, and it was one of, I think it made my top 10 for the year. So
yeah, I feel like this could gain a lot of buzz for the Academy Awards, just in conversation, because like you said, it wasn't really heavily advertised.
But the more people see it between like now and
yeah, and I feel like Whiplash kind of did that last year.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't hear a lot about it until it came out, and then just people talking about it and how awesome it was. I feel like this could do something like that and maybe pick up a few more awards than people might expect.
Mm. Well, it wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing. It's always interesting to see who it's against. I think it's been a really strong strong year in movies, so it's hard to kind of get behind any one thing, but there's been a lot of great movies this year and a lot of great performances. And because there's been so many great performances, there's been so many great movies, we've had a lot of great conversations. But great conversations don't happen without great guests. So I want you, the listeners, to be able to continue these conversations, to get a hold of our guests and ask them more questions or ask them to flesh out a thought maybe we didn't have a time to hit on for very long. So with that said, Gene, how can people follow you or follow your work or interact with you?
You can find me on Twitter at Wizard of Gauze. That's Wizard with no A. That's my brand new Twitter handle, y'all. Brand spanking new. And I'm on Letterboxd as well. Just search Gene Gosler and you'll find me on there.
Cool. And Clay, how can people follow what you do or interact with you?
You can start with Twitter, Clay Morgan PA.
That seems a bit of a lie, doesn't it?
A bit of a lie. Because I'm not there too much anymore.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, I'm there. I'm always checking. I'm interacting weekly with people. I am more active on Facebook. But really, just go to our blog, NorvalRogers.com. If you don't know how to spell it, just Google Shaggy from Scooby-Doo, and you'll see his real name is Norval Rogers. So we have about pages there, and you can check out my co-authors and I, and you can see some of our greatest hits.
Awesome. And if you want to follow me, do so on Twitter at Fizzification. All the show notes and ways to get a hold of these guys will be at realworldtheology.com. So make sure you're going to realworldtheology.com. Because we're so incredibly grateful that people would take time to have these conversations. So follow their work, check in on them, do that thing. What else? Oh, yes. You guys, the listeners, this show would not be possible without you listening to it. So thank you so much for taking time to make us part of your week. And I commend to you that until next episode, please remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
Later.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!
All right, here we go. Here's the
reveal.
See
what you're working with. I'll tell you. Gene wants to show video. It sounds so ominous. I will accept this video of a bearded man.
There it comes.
Oh man.